far are you going?
About 30 years.
In this week's episode, we celebrate the 20th anniversary of Ghost in the Shell with special guest Gerald Rathkolb of the Anime World Order podcast. The part I should probably do an introduction so it's not so awkward.
All right, so just go straight into it, I say, huh?
Yeah, that's how we do it. We don't play around on this podcast. All right, so hello, welcome to the Anime of Yesteryear podcast. I am one of your co-hosts, Dustin, and with me is John.
Hey.
And this week we have a special guest with us from the Anime World Order podcast, Gerald Rathkolb. I probably should have let him say his own name because I probably would have butchered it.
Hey, how you guys doing? This is, that was about as close as anyone can get it anyway. This is Gerald Rathkolb from the Anime World Order podcast.
Okay, so I did a pretty good job saying your last name.
Yeah, it's kind of an impossible name to say, so it works.
It's only two syllables. I don't know how people can mess that up. It's like Rath and Kolb, or Klob. But
they're two syllables that don't exist in English together.
Look, they're traced down from Latin in some way decades and eons ago. So there is an origin
I'm
for
sure.
Your last name somewhere. but Gerald, if you don't mind, tell us a little bit about yourself before we get into our review.
Sure. Well, I've been doing the anime podcasting thing as of December 17th. It'll be 10 years doing anime podcasting.
Wow.
Which makes us the longest continuously running anime-only podcast on the internet that I can think of. There's a lot of qualifiers there, I admit. Whole lot of qualifiers there.
Well, Dave and Joel beat you first.
Dave and Joel are not anime only. And they are a video game podcast with some anime in it.
Well, God willing, they try. I mean,
yes, they do. And I wish they would put out more anime episodes. But I guess there isn't as much JoJo's coming out since it's off season.
Yeah.
So we're pretty proud of that. We managed to get an episode out every once in a while. We're going to be recording another one very soon. I myself have been watching anime since about 1989 or so. It's before that, I knew it was Japanese. I just didn't really know a whole lot about it.
Uh-huh.
And so being an anime fan in the Virgin Islands, you kind of had to persevere. And so that's kind of what got me on this anime track. And
okay.
So I'm here to talk about a seminal anime from my childhood.
I mean, there's a way to put it in perspective. It's like from 89, think of all the other ways you could have used your life than watching anime.
Well, remember, I mean, in 89 and in that time period, I was living in the Virgin Islands. And there is, if you do not really love
soccer,
windsurfing and scuba diving, these things that people go on vacation to do, like these things, the people will go out of their way to do this, and I couldn't give a shit about all of this stuff. So I hate beaches. I never have to live by a beach for the rest of my life. Done with beaches. I did windsurfing. Hated it. Like, I did windsurfing an entire summer. Hated it. It's one of my least favorite things ever. I don't fish. I don't boat. I'm not an outside person. And so it was basically anime and video games. That's just what I could do inside. And anime was very hard because we didn't have very many video stores in the Virgin Islands.
Mm-hmm.
I had to order a lot of stuff through mail order, through comic book stores, actually, or on the occasional trips to the United States when I could pick stuff up at regular comic book stores. And that's then we finally got that. This name will seem like nothing this will be completely forgotten to some of your younger listeners, but we got a store called a Sam Goody down there.
I know what a Sam Goody is, yeah.
Yeah, they're completely gone now, but that was where you bought your music and your videos at the time. And so they had an anime section that was basically financed entirely by me. So
yeah, it's always like you're that one guy in the area, and it's like they only have an anime section because you're that one guy that's going to be the only one there to pick all this stuff up. Otherwise, it's like, well, how are we going to make 10% of our business a month without that one guy just buying anime?
Yeah, I must have put in – I must have bought like a tape every week or two there. It was – I don't know. I never saw anybody else in that anime section ever. It was only me. And so – and I never saw it really increase or decrease – I never saw it decrease without me buying something. So it must have just been basically me and maybe some tourists once in a while. It was – but yeah, you had to persevere because like nobody in my school watched anime. Like even when I talk to my friends here, they say, yeah – I knew some anime fans in school, and they were all really annoying. I'm like, I would have loved to have some annoying anime fan friends, because that would have been – I mean, I knew one other person that watched anime.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of watching an art form, I guess, or a video form, like it's – yeah, always it's always good to do it around people.
In terms of just having a hobby, it is nice to share it with anyone else. I mean, I went to a school where it was incredibly rare for anyone to play video games. Like, this was how horrible and shitty the school I went to was.
This is like, in the Virgin Islands?
This is in the Virgin Islands.
Okay.
Like, people down there, I look back on it now and I'm like, what the fuck did everybody do there for their, in their spare time?
Windsurfing, bro!
Literally, it must have been like they surfed, they smoked pot, and they went to a reggae concert or something. I can't think of anything else to do in that place. The Caribbean, in general, is a great place to visit. Go there for a vacation. Don't live there, ever.
I don't think we've ever gotten an answer like this from any other podcast if you're on their shows. Like, this is fascinating to me.
it's interesting when I look back on it that I was able to become the anime fan that I was, because when you're completely isolated, mm-hmm. it's very hard. Because a lot of people become anime fans because they know someone else who kind of guides them into it.
Mm-hmm.
Like oftentimes, you know, when you're young, there's someone older who can say, well, you know, check this out or check that out, or, you know, you might want to avoid this or avoid that. And I had no one like that.
Yeah.
I just had to watch anything I could find.
So how did you first find out about anime anyway?
When I I came to the Virgin Islands from South Africa, and in South Africa we had one television channel that was on like half a day, and it was called TV1. And they would play Robotech, but they would also play like a mixture of a couple of European things. Like I believe I got to watch Heidi at the time as well.
Okay.
And so that was, I remember watching Robotech and thinking like, this is completely different. Even as a little kid, you could tell like this is a completely different thing than any other cartoon out there. There is nothing that has the sort of detail, nothing that has the sort of action. Because if you weren't watching Robotech, what was the American counterpart? I mean, the American counterpart certainly in the mid-80s, Hanna-Barbera was putting out garbage. Most of the stuff they were putting out was actually just retreads of what they were doing in the 70s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a lot of comedy stuff. It was a lot of like Scooby-Doo and the Hare-Bear Bunch. And the only closest thing that you can think of on the American side might have been like Johnny Quest. And again, Johnny Quest is a show from like the late 60s, early 70s or so. So again, well before my time, but there was nothing else that was comparable. Robotech and the Japanese animation are the only thing that looked like it and had sort of the only thing that was seemingly made with a mind to keep you interested.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else in American animation, and certainly at the time, was just boring
throwaway.
And repetitive. Yeah, sorry?
It's like throwaway time. It's just like, you know, keep the kids entertained for 20 or odd, 30 odd minutes or so. And like anything
yes.
they just saw, there's no reason to retain it because there's nothing, there's no substance there.
And not only that, the idea was every episode was exactly the same. Every episode of Scooby-Doo, exactly the same. Every episode of anything Hanna-Barbera. Hanna-Barbera is you know, awful. And I'm glad they don't really exist anymore. Because, like, they had no sense of, you know, adventure or anything. They basically just said, we need to create this show with these sorts of characters, write one episode, and then change up the villain.
The villain's name.
Yes, change the villain's name and a bit of the design, and then you have a series. And that's it.
And they did several dozen Scooby-Doo ripoffs, you know.
Yes.
They're all almost exactly the same. There's, like, I can't remember the names of them, but there are even other ones with dogs that talk and everything, and it's all very derivative of their own product over and over.
Yeah, they would literally, like, be ripping off themselves constantly. And also on that subject, I mean, this was a time when Disney was putting out things, and this is, you know, going from the 80s into the 90s. The 80s was a very dark period for Disney. And then the 90s, late 80s, early 90s was supposedly this, like, Disney renaissance where they put out, like, The Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast and all that. And again, mm-hmm. I hated that shit. I hate musicals. And this Disney stuff was garbage to me. It was maybe very good technically, but there was no sense of adventure or excitement. They were all just these fairy tales. There was no, like, science fiction. There was nothing, like, I don't think anybody designed, you know, a robot or anything for any Disney movie ever until, like, Treasure Island, or Treasure Planet, I should say, which was garbage as well. And so I came from that generation as well, and this is a rare sort of generation to come from. There aren't a lot of us out there who came to anime as a rejection of Disney. Mm-hmm. A lot of people came to anime as an extension of their interest in Disney. And I was completely the opposite. I said, I don't like this Disney stuff. I want something that's different, that's more challenging, that's more interesting. And so that's kind of part of how I came to it.
All right.
that is a long-winded answer, I suppose.
Nah. I mean, I was a little kid in the early 90s, so that was in that Disney renaissance. And, I mean, to my mind, I think probably my favorite Disney movie of that era was Rescuers Down Under.
Which is probably the most different one that they made. And that's one of them that I actually like, because it wasn't a goddamn musical.
It was an adventure movie in the Outback with George C. Scott.
There was something interesting and slightly different in that.
It was a pretty dark movie, too.
Yeah, and it's a shame that that was one of their less successful movies, and then they never did anything else with the Rescuers, because that was the second Rescuers movie.
Yeah.
And that's a real shame, because I really, really like those characters, and that was kind of the last one that they did that was slightly adventurous. I'm glad that it's a little bit different now, largely because John Lasseter has taken over all of the animation at Disney, and now they're now, you know, because everybody at Pixar are anime fans to a degree. Well, let me rephrase that. Pixar aren't anime fans, they're Ghibli fans. And so there's a lot of, you know, influence from that, which is not bad. I would still like to see them be a little bit more adventurous. But it's still hell of a lot better than it was, where every year you just got yet another old story and an old musical. And it was even worse, because at the time, when we had music class in middle school and lower school and such,
we had to
learn all the music from the Disney movie that year for, you know, the spring concert.
I mean, like, what instrument did you play in music class, may I ask?
Oh, I never played instruments. Never instruments. It was always just singing.
Oh, okay.
No, I have no musical talent.
They made me play a recorder in elementary school.
I did that too, but I did sax in fifth grade and trumpet in sixth.
Yeah, I did the recorder as well, but I don't count that as an instrument, because you've never heard anything sound good on a recorder. There's no professional recorder, like, musician out there.
Everyone's first song is that do 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 do. It was something like that. That was, like, the first thing we ever learned.
Usually, or something like that.
That's so stupid. Why is there anything?
No one in the entire, like, there are professional trumpet players and you know, guitar players and everything. There's no professional recorder player. It must be the worst thing in the world to be the music teacher and get to that time where you have to teach the kids the recorder and just hear.
That's like your low point in your life. It's like, God, what is my career taking me to teach kids the recorder?
Yeah. Not even a flute, because a flute's a real instrument. The recorder. So. Every year we had to sing the Disney songs from that year. Once in a while we even had to do like a performance. And so it was, you know, Disney inundation. And so that was just what I had to deal with. And then so that's, you know, my escape was going to the video store and renting some of the four kids, you know, hack jobs of anime. But even the hack jobs of the anime that they put out, stuff like
Macross, do you remember Clash of the Binoids.
Clash of the Binoids, they put out Revenge of the Ninja, and even these
Space
hack
Warriors.
Jobs, Space Warriors, were way more interesting than anything Disney was doing. I was like, holy shit, this is set in space! There's robots here! There's things exploding! Nothing like that happens in Disney stuff.
Macron 1, 2, 2, 2.
Yep. And so, because I just liked robots and all that sort of stuff, that's kind of how it all sort of drifted towards that.
I was about to say, I mean, we could always skip on Ghost in the Shell and just hear a life story about anime. I don't mind.
I'm sure that Ghost in the Shell is far more interesting than my boring life story.
All right. Well, you're our guest, so it's your call. Well, that's our intended purpose for this podcast anyways, was to talk about Ghost in the Shell since it debuted November 18th, 1995, and so we're 4 days away from the 20th anniversary. I guess it aired at a film festival like in October or something, and then it went to like international release, the way I understand it.
I believe it did air at Cannes, or was entered for Cannes, and a couple of other conventions at the time. But I guess we should go back a bit further. We're talking specifically about the first Ghost in the Shell movie from 1995, the Mamoru Oshii one.
Right.
Based upon a manga by Masamune Shirow. Have either of you read the manga?
No.
I have read very little of it and just like kind of flipped through like the panels and stuff and the scenes of that, but I've never read it from cover to cover.
Now, I did read the manga. I've actually got my copy of the 19... This is the original...
Is that the Dark
Horse?
Oh, is
this
that
is
like
the Dark
Horse
1995 release of the Tankobon.
Okay. Is that the censored or uncensored one?
This was the censored version. They didn't release an uncensored version until about 2001 or 2. And the part that was uncensored is really just three pages of what would sex be like in a in a virtual environment.
The ocean.
And I mean, it's overly explicit more than it needs to be, but that scene that was censored makes no sense in the uncensored version. Because the scene in question is a scene where Makoto is having sex. She's on this, like, it's all in virtual reality. She's on this, like, boat with three of her female companions, and they were having, like, this lesbian orgy. And Bato sort of sneaks into this. And because he doesn't have the organs that the program is written for, basically like crashes his system, and then he punches himself in the face. It's kind of like a crash. And this makes very little sense, but in the context of the comic itself, it makes much more sense in the context of, oh, they were having sex and he doesn't have a vagina. But none of that happens in the actual movie itself. The manga itself is prototypical 1980s cyberpunk, something that's a completely dead genre. In fact, it was a dead genre when the manga itself was released in America, because you know cyberpunk is very, very 1980s. There hasn't been like the last cyberpunk movie that you could argue that America made was maybe like Johnny Mnemonic.
I was about to say that. Well, what about like Strange Days? That's cyberpunk also in a way.
Strange Days, yeah. And again, we're moving further and further away from it. The paranoia that inspired cyberpunk is different now and in the mid-90s than what first inspired it in the first place, the idea of these gigantic corporations and, you know, this worldwide sort of ability to communicate with each other, which, you know, back in the 80s was, you know, brand new. And in the 90s, as the 90s went on in the 2000s, it's just how every day of our lives is. I mean, I'm talking to you guys on Skype. You guys are you know, across the country, and it's not even a big deal. But the manga is interesting because the manga was written in 1988. And so the movie came out in 1995, and then we got the Innocent sequel around 2002, 3, something like that.
I think it was about 03.
'03, that sounds about right. Then we got Ghost in the Shell 2.0, which I guess we'll get to later. But yeah, I do not mean to take over your podcast, guys. We can go at your pace. It is interesting. If you have read the manga, the anime, the movie, very much basically what Mamoroshi seemed to do is he read this manga and said, okay, we're going to take this story and we're going to take, you know, this tiny chunk here and bits and pieces here and there, and then we're going to kind of create a movie that's sort of disjointed. In the end, it has kind of a point, but we'll just kind of take like the effect of the main thread of the manga and go with that.
Yeah, the way
he doesn't do very literal adaptations like manga fans seem to prefer these days. But I mean, I know I read that he received death threats for his Urusei Yatsura films, so. Because they're too different from the manga.
And so Mamoroshi is kind of his own guy, or at least at that time he was. And so he just kind of took this thing and said, well, how can we turn this thing? And at the time, it was crazy to think this, because Mamoroshi was a well-known manga director at the time, and the stuff that he was well known for making were these really deep and complex movies, or at least these movies with sort of a deep and complex idea, like Beautiful Dreamer. He also had done Pat Labor 1 and Pat Labor 2, which are classics. Certainly Pat Labor 2.
He worked on the Pat Labor OVAs also, like a few of the episodes, especially like the latter two of the SV2's Longest Day.
Yes, which were the primer for Pat Labor 2.
Yeah.
And these were all very sort of deep and complex movies. And then Masamune Nishiro was also known at the time through some American comic book artists, like J. Scott Campbell was a big fan of Mamoroshi.
I thought Adam Warren was also.
Adam Warren? He probably was. I mean, it's impossible to be that aware of Japanese manga and anime without being aware of Masamune Nishiro at the time.
Yeah.
And again, he was also known for these really complex ideas. And I mean, have either of you read what is the manga that I'm thinking of? Not Ghost in the Shell, but Orion. Have you guys read Orion?
No.
I have one of the issues for that. I think I've skimmed through it.
Most obtuse, complex comic you will ever read in your life. It's one of the only things that Masamune Nishiro has done that's never been adapted into an anime and never will be, because it makes no sense. Combine like Buddhism and quantum dynamics, and this gets you an idea of what Orion is about. Orion, by the way, was the last original manga that Masamune Nishiro worked on that wasn't a sequel, and that was in 1991.
And this was all... I was going to say, this is all before the era of drawing horse porn.
The era of horse porn is 10 years ago now. 12, 15 years ago now. He's now onto like new stuff, new forms of whatever. He doesn't do manga, because why would you want to plot out a thing with characters and plot and, you know, page frames and all that, when you can just draw one big picture of a naked girl, very shiny naked girl, and do that, you know, 10, 15 times and sell an art book then.
Yeah, because porn doesn't need plot. Never does.
No, not really. Well, and so, he hasn't done, like, the last manga I think he did might have been the Man-Machine Interface, which was the second Ghost in the Shell manga, which I own, but I have not read yet, and is universally disliked.
That's what I hear about it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, the anime was... It was an interesting project. It was probably the most anticipated anime project ever at the time. Uh, like, this is one of those few times where we knew that this was being made in Japan, that this was coming out. There was promotion for this that was a big, big deal. It got a theatrical run in the U.S. I didn't get to see that because I lived in fucking Virgin Islands. It's actually hard for me to think of if there has been a bigger anticipated anime-specific release. I don't know if the Ghibli stuff counts, like, you know, Spirited Away and such.
Right.
But this probably Steam Boy. When Steam Boy, before it came out, there was an enormous amount of anticipation about that. Then it came out, and we watched it, and we're like, well, this was a big mistake.
I was going to say, like, in terms of the manga chapters that was adapted from, or at least into the film, it was like only, like you said, like it's not a straightforward adaptation from the manga, like in terms of one section, but it's just like you said, where Oshii took some things out of it and just kind of did his own thing, and Shiro was like, yeah, go ahead, I don't really care.
I mean, Shiro was, you know, making plenty of money at the time, even then, but Oshii probably did as good a job with the material that he had, not to say that the material is very different. The Ghost in the Shell is one of these things where every single version of Ghost in the Shell is kind of this completely different approach to the material. Like the manga, the original material is this sort of weird sort of gobbledygook of these ideas that are very sort of strange. And it's kind of like reading a Michael Crichton book where, you know, someone will say something, and then there'll just suddenly be this like 5-page aside of, like, for example, there was this one moment in the manga where one of these nurses were talking about, these nurses were working on this one guy's brain, and suddenly there's this big aside of like, well, you know that in fiber optics there are certain light particles that actually can reach there, that can actually, you know, get bounced back and reach their destination, and this is, you know, how they anticipate, you know, feeling to work in fiber optics. And this is, you know, a big aside in it. And that's how the manga works. And, you know, the Oshii anime is this very sort of existential, sort of weird, I don't know how to describe it, sort of philosophical approach. To the work.
Yeah, I think that's the best way you can describe it is going,
And then, you know, the standalone complex is kind of the procedural criminal minds NCIS or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Arise, which I haven't seen, is a piece of shit. Again, I haven't seen that, but no one I know really likes Arise.
Arise is okay. Maybe that's why it's okay. It might be crappy, but
how much of it have you seen, Dustin?
I saw up to the third one, and then there's like apparently two more. And, like, there's some sort of movie that ties it up, so I haven't gotten around to watching those yet. But, like, it's, like, when I look at Arise, it's like, okay, I know it's there. I'll watch it eventually, and then I just kind of forget about it.
I saw the first episode on Netflix, but I haven't seen the rest yet. Is the new movie that is in theaters this last week and this upcoming week tied in with Arise, then?
I thought it was. It was supposed to tie up, like, some plot to Arise, or maybe that was the other movie that they did that was part of Arise.
My original understanding was that new movie was meant to tie sort of everything together, like Arise and Standalone Complex. That's what I'd heard.
I don't really understand the whole continuity of all these things. I thought they were all separate, except for like Standalone is connected with the Solid State Society.
And I guess, you know, I guess Ghost in the Shell, the first movie, is tied in with Ghost in the Shell Innocence.
Right, yeah, that too.
The Ghost in the Shell movie is, I guess we're going to be talking about both it and 2.0.
I haven't really seen 2.0, but if you've seen it, you're welcome to tell all about the changes. The only one I can tell right off the bat by looking at it is color. And
I don't know if we want to get into it yet, but since we brought it up, we might as well. Ghost in the Shell 2.0 was this sort of re-release of this DVD remaster of the first movie. The motivation for it makes no sense to me because it was the opening sequence was done in CG this time. The original opening sequence was all 2D animated.
That's as far as I've seen as the opening sequence, and I was just like, I can't, no, and it just kind of threw me off a little bit. But go ahead.
And the many sequences were recolored. The predominant color scheme for the original movie
is blue and green and cool color shades and everything like that.
Yeah, it was the cool color shades, while the predominant color for Innocence was warm colors, yellows and oranges and reds. And I don't get this. The Innocence movie was not popular anywhere. Nobody liked that movie a whole lot. It was not liked in Japan. It came out in America. No one really liked it. The director didn't even want to do it. He did it because they said to Oshii, look, if you want to make another movie with us, you better make another Ghost in the Shell. So why would you re-release Ghost in the Shell, the original Ghost in the Shell, and try to tie it in visually with this movie that no one liked?
And it takes away from the original too, but in terms of like when you use color in something, especially in art, like there's color adds a thematic element to it in terms of the mood, the setting, and everything. So when you add like a cooler color, it gives this environment like a cyberpunk environment of like a desolate, very downtrodden, depressing feel to like Ghost in the Shell. And that's kind of part of one of its themes. Whereas if you try to lighten that up and change it in 2.0, you get a different message with the same story that's already kind of tied to that color theme. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, that color scheme was chosen for a reason. And then to change it after the fact, I don't know what they were trying to do. The motivation is completely lost on me. It makes no sense. It was completely unnecessary. At the very least, it's not like the Star Wars movies, where when those re-releases of the Star Wars movies came out, you couldn't get the original movies. At the very least, they included the original movie unremastered in non-high def on the Blu-ray disc.
Okay.
So it's there. I wish that would have gotten an HD remaster, not this completely unnecessary, superfluous, pointless sort of redo of the movie. But yeah, that like they retimed the opening. And the cutting in of the CG animation with the 2D animation is incredibly awkward. In the original movie, the only CG that was there was usually computer graphics. And I mean, I say computer graphics were the only CG. That's dumb. But what I mean by that is, graphical information on screens.
Like a GPS. Like if they're looking at a map, like, okay, this car's going here. You better tail them, Bato, and everything. Like that was the only like CG-looking thing. But that was also kind of put cell animation over that too. So it didn't look entirely like CGI.
Right. And, I mean, it made sense because this was, a computer program that it was looking into. Mm-hmm. And now they decided to implement the CG in the real world of that movie. And it completely doesn't work. It just makes no sense to me why it was even done. I have no clue. And, but that was, I mean, it's there. At least I have the original. So I can't complain about it too much. I do have the original there.
Well, the 2.0 does have the original movie on there, like in the bonus section. So, like, there's a way for me to watch it on a Blu-ray disc at my leisure. I don't know. Does it look real? I mean, I think it looks pretty good with it being on there. I don't know if it's 720 or 1080.
It's definitely not remastered or high def. It's standard def. So it's no better than you would have on a DVD.
Okay.
And I would like to see that get a proper remaster with a proper like 5.1 or DTS, discrete soundtrack,
mm-hmm.
something like that. But the fact that I have it is okay. It's there. So
yeah. I guess in terms of Ghost in the Shell plot, to really sum it up, I mean, it's about we're seen as this person is a woman by the name of Major Motoko Kusanagi. And she's part of this government organization called Section 9, and they're, basically after, just to really sum it up, they're after this hacker person called the Puppet Master. And then we find out more, like, where the Puppet Master came from, kind of, and sort of his sole intended purpose is why he does the things that he does. And that's pretty much, like, the simple overarching to it, or at least the plot for it. But then Oshii goes into a lot of thematic elements that I don't know if you've read Brian Ruh's Stray Dog of Anime book, where he like kind of dissects all of Oshii's films up until I think it was like Skycrawlers or something.
I haven't read it. So.
I have read that, but it was a long time ago, and so I wonder like if I even remember.
Okay.
some of the bits.
I had a I had a contemporary art class, and I wound up doing a project on Mamoru Oshii, and like I only picked really like the four main films. Like it was Urusei Yatsura, Pat Labor, Ghost in the Shell, and then I also did like a little really quick write up on Angel's Egg. And
oh gosh, Angel's Egg! Jeez, there have been theses written on that.
Yeah, they're still online today, but I mean. After, like, at least on reading, like, Angel's Egg, like, at least I had, like, sort of a better appreciation for it. And granted, like, Brian Rowe's book is just really based on, like, sort of an academic opinion on the things that he finds. But at least it kind of gives you, like, a different outlook on the films.
Yeah, I mean, Brian Rowe, I highly respect him as well. And so anything that he says about Oshii, like, I take that as kind of the English language authority on that.
Yeah.
So
anybody can write a book about anything, but in order for a book to come from someone that has like, I think he's got a master's or a doctorate in it, then that's sort of like up there in terms of like what is really more authoritative than anything else that you can write about.
Yeah, I have read some of his papers mm-hmm. as well on Oshii, and they were also excellent. And so, if you want to find out more about Oshii, that's kind of the best resource is Brian, an English language resource would be kind of Brian mm-hmm. Ra's, anything Brian Ra. I forgot his name on Twitter. I know he follows me and I follow him. I'm just blanking on what his name might be.
I can pull it up, or at least you could.
Yeah, it's just Brian Ra. Never mind.
Yeah, at Brian Ra.
Yep, so that makes sense. Yeah, PhD.
That didn't take you too much thought to figure that out. No, but like I'm glad like someone that educated is able to you know, like, be able to put this much time and effort into figure out, like, Mamoru Oshii films. And at least for me, like, when I think of A Ghost in the Shell and the stuff that I read about it, like, there were some things that he wrote that I was, like, I don't really get or maybe I disagree about, but at least that has my own opinion. And I think when Oshii does these films, he kind of wants people to look at it through their own opinion and their own outlook of what they're trying to interpret and the things that they see. And there's some thematic elements I can pick up on where it was, like in the book, Rudd wrote about how the Basset Hound was sort of a symbol of like loneliness or like isolation and everything. So when it comes to the garbage truck guy explaining that he's got a wife and kids and everything that don't exist, then there's like a photo of him with the Basset Hound, which is kind of showing that he's this alone, isolated person and he's a mm-hmm. victim of these like ghost hacks and everything. And right. There's also, I was going to say the other thing, scene that I, at least the way I look at it is, the one on the boat where she's going down the river and Motoko sees two versions of herself. There's one version of herself in a cafe that's kind of moving and alive and everything. And then she crosses over a bridge where the Basset Hound is at. And then there's another like version of her, like as a mannequin in a store. And so I always see that as a transition from being like an alive person, you know, being active in society and everything, and then you cross that bridge of what the Basset Hound represents, and then you become this like alone, ignored object or being around society. And so that's kind of like this conflicting thing where she's, you know, also conflicted of like, the only reason I know that I'm human is the way I'm treated by people, but then does that really make me a human being even though I'm just an artificial intelligence inside of a robotic body?
And that is, well, I mean, that's part of the question is she doesn't know. I think that was part of the question in the movie, certainly, was mm-hmm. her brain is inside that body, but what they're able to do now is they're able to move your consciousness from one body to another. So does she even know if that brain that's inside her body was even her original brain? And you're right, if it isn't, like what does it mean to be human? What is this consciousness? And these are the questions that movie brings up in a big way.
Yeah.
That movie is, I mean, Oshii is one of those anime directors who, and he, I remember hearing commentaries and interviews with people that he worked with. The director of, I believe, Project Eiko, Yuji Moriyama, mm-hmm. Would talk about, because he worked with Oshii on Urusei Yatsura.
Yeah, because they all came from the same studio, and that's when they kind of went and did their own thing. So
yeah, and Oshii was kind of the teacher of all of them, and would say, you know, make every scene mean something. Have Never just put in a scene just because it's there. Have something mean something. And he was referring to this from Project Echo because there was a scene where a character was waiting outside of a school and there was just a shot of her shoes and there were these ants crawling over her shoes. And he was saying, like, that was meant to show very specifically, like, she has been there so long that the ants have even forgotten that she's there. I mean, Oshii is one of those few people where you reading deeply into his work makes sense because it's designed to be done that way.
Yeah.
Not a lot of anime is really meant for that, or certainly not as much as the college senior writing his thesis wants to pretend.
That's
coming
true,
from that
yeah.
myself.
But
yeah, there's certainly a lot in Ghost in the Shell. The thing with Ghost in the Shell is that it's such a weird sort of disjointed work because it takes those bits and pieces mm-hmm. from the manga and doesn't necessarily tie them all together very well. Like, it almost feels like we're watching a compilation movie because it starts out with this murder of this diplomat and yeah. then it moves on to, you know, it moves on from there and then suddenly things fade out and it fades back in and then we get the naked girl on the highway who is this body that the puppet master inhabited.
Yeah.
And, like, this could almost be three episodes of an anime series. Or two or three or four episodes of just a series that was just mm-hmm. sort of strung together.
Another thing I thought of too was, I mean, there's a couple of things that in the movie in terms of, I know Brian mentioned that, like, in the very beginning when, like, the diplomat is working with, like, the computer engineer and everything, and then, like, Motoko assassinates him, and there's sort of a way where he puts it to, basically within that split second, you see basically the fall of man. In terms of like how everything's around art is artificial and nothing's really real, even though like people are supposed to look real. It was something like that. And I think the other big one is, during the final fight when the Tachikoma tank was shooting up the Tree of Life.
Yes.
And then it ends right at the Latin term for human. And there's actually sort of an art term for that, which is called a, memento mori, which is like remember your morality or humanity or whatever. And so that's kind of a way of Oshii saying, you know, if technology keeps continuing, there won't be any more there won't be a mankind to exist. Which is
and
something else I found really interesting.
Yeah, I'm sure that is what Oshii meant.
Yeah.
This is not, you know, Genno Urobuchi, who would have stopped the movie and said, you know, that Latin term, and have two characters discuss it and say, that Latin term there means human. And if we keep going, we're not going to be human anymore. Like, thanks, Genno Urobuchi, you're respected. Respected writer, why?
if we tried, we can figure this out on our own, and that's kind of what Oshii's like. His thing is making these movies is that he wants people to figure out his messages on their own. Even if you and I have completely different opinions on the same message, at least we put some thought into it. And
yeah, Oshii comes, I guess, from it used to be the new school, and now I guess it's the old school of mm-hmm. sort of this writing. Like, would you come away with it? Is more important than what I put into it. And then the characters like Genno Urobuchi are more like, I have this message. I want to make sure you understand what my message is. I was just playing Metal Gear Solid Phantom Pain. And there's a point in it, without any spoilers, there's a point in it.
Okay, good.
I'm going to open no spoilers here. There's a point in it where there is a character that, and in this scene, there is a character with a conch shell and a pig on a stick. Like pig head on a stick.
Yeah.
And this is directly out of Lord of the Flies. And this was meant to be an homage or like a mention to like, well, there's a reason why these are there. And you're just supposed to be able to figure that out. It's not stopped. It's not described. It's not, nothing else goes into it. It's just there. And when you actually see that scene, it makes a lot more sense. Like why that's there.
Okay.
So, no spoilers. Nothing's been spoiled.
I think I know what you're talking about because I probably went past that point. That's on the main story, right?
Yes, main story.
Okay. Yeah, I there is a bit of from what I've played in a certain part of Metal Gear Solid 5, it's very Lord of the Flies kind of thing. So
a certain part of it, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I guess for me, like another thing I could ask you is that since you're more of like for me when I noticed, like, when this movie came out in the States and was, like, you know, the billboards number one and everything, and I would go in the malls, like, they had, like, I remember seeing advertisements, like, around video stores, like, Suncoast or Sam Goody and everything that would have like a poster for Ghost in the Shell. And I just remember seeing it, but I didn't know anything about it because I was like 10 or 11 at the time. And, you know, it was years before I ever got into seeing it in high school. But I was just actually curious, like, how did the – like, at the time when you saw it, like, how did the anime community react? Like, what was, like, your first impression with it and everything?
This was – it was a big deal. Like, you were born in what, like, 92, 91?
I'm 86.
86. Okay, that would make sense. Yeah, then you were, like, 9 or 10.
Yeah.
When it came out. Yeah. And so, yeah, we're not that much – I'm not that much older than you.
I turned 30 in a couple of months, so that's my – Logan's Run expiration date movie.
I passed that expiration date a few years ago, not too many. But this was a big, 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 big deal. Like, much, much bigger deal than we remember, because this was the first anime that was heavily sort of advertised to the regular sort of buying community,
mm-hmm.
and got a lot of exposure in stores. It was put like in the front there. When you walked into the store, there was a full shelf of Ghost in the Shell discs, or the Ghost in the Shell VHS tapes. And like, this was the first time that happened. Anime had always been in the stores, but it never got that sort of exposure. And the anime community at the time were not necessarily that big on the movie itself. I remember watching it the first time and thinking, like, well, you know, this is okay. But I had to. It's a movie you have to watch like three times before anything makes sense.
Yeah.
This was a movie where my friends in school could say, "Yeah, this anime stuff that you watch, like, I saw that this was, you know, in the store, and I saw it was being played on like the video screens in the store and such." And so this was. I remember I went to New York City shortly after that came out, and I went to that. This existed at the time. I went to the Virgin Megastore, and they had mm-hmm. a giant display of Ghost in the Shell. And next to that, they had a big display of anime. And the Ghost in the Shell kind of pulled anime along with it. And then with it, at the time, they had come out with this release of Aeon Flux, which was not anime, but was kind of the most closely associated thing with anime.
Yeah, that was. That was the Aeon Flux that was like the shorts on MTV at the time, right?
Yeah, but that was Peter Chung. Those shorts are cool as shit as long as you stop watching as soon as the main character starts talking. Because there were a whole bunch that were just completely silent, and then suddenly at some point they decide to let the main character talk, and then it's just bad.
Yeah, I know they had extended episodes. That came out later, but then there was just a bunch of shorts that was on MTV, and they would be like 5 or 10 minutes long. And those are the ones that are really cool that I've seen. Yes.
Yeah, some of those things are super cool, like the interstitial of the eye, and then this fly is walking over the eye, and then the main character like closes her eyelashes and then catches the fly in the eyelashes. It's a very, very cool sequence. And it's unfortunately the only time that Peter Chung has done something that was really cool. Everything else he's done and involved himself with has been kind of lame.
Yeah. Well, I mean, talking about 90s MTV cartoons, that's a whole other discussion there.
Yeah. And I mean, a lot of that were the very, very early influences of anime.
Yeah.
But yeah, Ghost in the Shell, and this was a time Manga Entertainment had entered the market. And they had entered the market, this was 1995, so Manga Entertainment entered the market maybe a year or so before.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the British company. They were bought by, they were managed by a much larger medium company, so they had much more money to work with in the English language world than a lot of other companies did at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they were pushing Ghost in the Shell really hard to a lot of these locations. And it was also a little bit worrisome because they would get licenses to things that they wanted to push that the anime community was like, well, I don't think people should see this. Like right around Ghost in the Shell, or right, I think before Ghost in the Shell, they licensed a Violence Jack and were pushing that. And the last thing anybody wants is some senator to walk in while his son is watching Violence Jack and watch the sequence where these women are drugged and then raped, and then
torn
as they're
apart.
Trying to escape, their throats are slit, and then they're raped while they're dead.
Yeah.
Like, this is not what anime needs.
Didn't they censor it, though, initially?
What?
Didn't they censor the Violence Jack release initially, though?
Yes, there was a censored version and an uncensored version. And then I believe the uncensored version was released by Right Stuff. And now Discotech has released all of that. If you have a super strong stomach.
I don't. I've watched that whole thing twice, and we did a review of it a couple of years ago, and I'm like,
it's
you
hard
know,
stuff.
I'm good. I don't need to see it forever again.
Violence Jack is something that it's kind of like when you're a film buff, and you are, and then someone says, "Well, you should watch Salo," and you're like, "Yeah, I need to watch Salo." Like as a film buff, I should watch this movie. I don't need to own it. I don't need to watch it again, but to expand my understanding of film, I should watch Salo.
Can you spell that in the message on Skype so at least I know what it is?
Isn't Salo. That the really long movie about the Holocaust?
It's Salo. It's called let me get the full title of it. It is Salo or 120 Days of Sodom. It is a movie. It is a Italian movie. The director of this was murdered after this movie came out. And it is based on 120 Days of Sodom by Marquis de Sade, and it is, yes, it's about the Holocaust, basically, and about this kidnap a bunch of teenagers and throw them into this sort of mansion and have them, like, eat shit and do all this, like, horrific stuff to them. It is not any fun to watch. It's one of these weird movies where apparently during the making of the movie, no one knew it was going to end up like this. It was all done in the editing room. The director was murdered after this movie came out. So it is one of those things where if you are a super hardcore film buff, it's something that probably you might want to watch at some point just so you can be part of the discussion. But it's like Violence
cool.
Jack. Like, yeah, like there is probably very little anime I can think of that has made me feel more uncomfortable than Violence Jack. And there's probably a reason why that was never, ever dubbed fully. Or the uncut version was never, ever dubbed, I should say.
Yeah.
Because I just can't imagine, like, showing this to your dubcast in the studio and being like, well, when your boyfriend's head is cut off, you know, scream a bit louder. Like, can you add some sort of, like, blubbering as your throat is cut right there? Yeah, that's right. No, I can't imagine, like, giving this direction there, but we are off topic. I'm talking about this and we should be talking about Ghost in the Shell.
Well, there's two options for Salo. There's the 116 minute version or the uncut 145 minute version. Pick your poison.
only for the super brave. That's super brave only.
So we'll put that under Gerald Rathkolb's
recommendations.
Make a man out of your recommendations for film.
Put my face on the front of the cover with a thumbs up. There we go.
You know what? If Destroy All Podcast is really man enough about reviewing films, they should cover this and give it a 5-star rating all the way. That's right. Shots fired, Jeremy.
But Ghost in the Shell, it was the biggest exposure that anime had had. And it's tough because the only other exposure that anime has really had to that degree has been Ghibli films, and that's because Disney has got the money and the influence, and and because, you know, certain people will push it. But those movies are so far outside of the norm of anime that it's hard to sort of equate them with the rest of anime. Ghost in the Shell was something that was much more similar to what anime fans were watching at the time. Like, anime fans weren't watching Kiki's Delivery Service and stuff. Families were watching that.
Well, you've got the kids that were watching Sailor Moon because that was on syndication on TV. Like, that's what I knew when I was in elementary school.
Yeah, Sailor Moon had been starting then.
Yeah.
Pokemon was running. None of that is like Ghibli. But, yeah, that was the start of where anime had kind of gone a bit more mainstream,
mm-hmm.
and had been, you know, more recognized. So there were still, I still remember seeing anime fans at the time, meeting them and talking to them about Pokemon, and they were like, but Pokemon's not anime. I'm like, no, it is. It is anime. It's maybe not what you watch, but it is anime.
I figured, like, that would have been I guess that kind of makes sense because, like, there was that sort of distinction in, like, what is considered people's general anime and everything. And, you know, when Pokemon came out, yeah, it's tying into a video game that a bunch of kids are going to buy. I mean, I got Pokemon Red when I was 13 for Christmas. Yeah, it was Red. But I mean, it's still an animated show that to try to be toyetic and sell on a game video game property. So.
Yeah, I mean, it was absolutely anime. That was just the attitude at the time was, if it's popular, it can't be anime.
There's still people who believe that. Dustin, do you remember when Josh sent an email to some shop owner that had Digimon, like, he put it in the children's section instead of the anime section or something, and Josh was, like, offended, and he was saying, like, this is really an anime because, you know, it's a Japanese animated series. By definition, it's anime, even if you don't like it because it's more commercial than other anime or more successful or whatever the complaint is that people have that leads them to think it's not really anime. Okay, I mean, I think a lot of people just think if it's popular, it can't be anime, or if it's popular with kids especially.
Okay, first of all, how long ago did this happen? I think I vaguely remember it.
It was maybe a year or two ago. It was pretty recently, though.
Okay, All right, then not. But, I mean, is
wow,
it really
going
to...
Was that recently where, you know, video stores were still a thing to write to them and complain about...
I guess
how
so.
How to set the store up?
Yeah, somewhere in Connecticut,
I think. My thing is, like, how hard is it for you to just go to the kids section and just look up, like, Digimon there? I mean... they're probably, like, right next to each other within 2 feet. I mean, or you could just take the DVDs of Digimon and shove them in the anime section and just walk out with your middle finger up, like, F you, I saved the world kind of thing.
Remember, prior to Ghost in the Shell, most video stores put anime in the sci-fi section. There wasn't even an anime section. It was just sci-fi, and you just had to look through the videos, and yeah, there might be an anime somewhere in there.
I think I kind of do remember that, and I think certain video stores that probably still exist, like, well, the only one I know of is Family Video, if you have one in town or something. There's one near
yeah, we've
my...
We've got movie stops here.
Okay.
So but, there's, yeah. And some FYEs are still holding on, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, like, certain areas will just, like, mix, like, science fiction or action with anime, too. So, like, that's, like, some of the movie store places, because their anime section isn't big enough to have an anime section anymore.
Yeah, I mean, nowadays, usually every one of those stores has got someone in there who knows a little bit more about anime to put it in its own section. But yeah, those video stores are a dying thing.
Yeah, I know there was a Suncoast that still existed in the Carytown Mall in Raleigh, North Carolina. And that's where I used to go to, like, all the time to get, like, a ton of discount stuff. And I guess eventually they came down and shut them down because it was always amazing. Like, I'd go to Animazement every year. And they would have a booth set up selling, like, the stuff out of their store there. And I guess
people
went over there and bought it. I got a free WWE, like, WrestleMania, like, handkerchief or, like, a headband or something. And I just walked over and took it. It wasn't a price tag, so I didn't really care. But, like, the owner's been – the guy – it's one of those guys that's been the owner of the store for, like, 20 years or something. And I would have, like, conversations with them and – I think they tried to get MS Igloo when there was, like, a thing about we're supposed to be released in America. And they were like, yeah, we have a pre-order for that. And I was like, yeah, put my name down. They never got it.
Huh.
That's more of a Bandai thing, probably, but.
Probably. I mean, it is no under-exaggeration to say that Suncoast is probably one of the entities that is the single most responsible for keeping anime fandom a thing in the late 80s into the 90s. I want to say up until is, you know, pretty much the entire 90s. Like,
yeah.
Suncoast was very much into the anime. You could go there and they would have the new stuff. You could pre-order stuff through them. And so that they pushed Ghost in the Shell very hard when that came out.
Yeah, I mean, the last time I was at the Suncoast that I knew, it was they had literally a section dedicated to anime. And they had some really good titles. It wasn't just 95% FYE Funimation titles everywhere like it always is. I don't know, like, I still go to FYE at the mall that I go to in Greenville. And it's like, why am I looking in the anime section? I know what's in here. It's anything that's on the Funimation site at the moment. But then there's always that one thing where I might find something used, like a used Dominion Tank Police DVD, which is something I gotten from there that was like $4 or something. And that's like a better well-spent money than like you know, 50% off like the newest Moe Girl show or something. I mean,
yeah, I mean the remember back then the idea of going to your Suncoast or your Sam Goody was because you didn't know what was out.
Yeah, they had everything.
Yeah, they had most. They had most everything, and you went there to see what was new. And nowadays, you know what's out. You know what's available. It's just they exist because I don't know. They're still hanging on.
Yeah, I just remember like when I noticed that, because I mean I was one of those kids in the late 90s that got into anime through Toonami, and like I remember like sixth grade, you know, I was being told about how awesome this Dragon Ball Z show was. And so I'd watch it, and then when I went to the mall like that weekend or something, like they had like a section of an anime section near the cash register of like their anime tapes. And so like I would go in there and like want to pick out a Dragon Ball Z tape and everything, but it was always $30-$35 for two or three episodes, which today you can get those tapes for less than 10 cents.
Yeah, you can't give those away. I mean, I actually gave away a lot of my VHS collection to a younger fan.
Yeah,
to a younger fan who wanted them as kind of, I don't know, it's almost kind of this weird, like, pop, like, punk thing. Like, I didn't know this, but, like, one of the most popular things in punk music now is selling your album on cassette tape.
Huh.
And I guess for some of the younger kids who have got sort of this connection to the older anime, to older, like, you know, world of anime, you know, in the 90s, like, owning those cassette tapes is kind of this sort of rite of passage or something.
Okay.
And so they can gladly take my cassette tapes. I have no use for them anymore.
I just look at it this way. Like, I mean, I got Arion, I got Toy from you, some Gale Force tape, and Arion too. I saw Arion and I got a clear picture about 20 minutes in. But, no, like, I just looked at it as I'm paying $4 for shipping for, like, stuff someone's giving away, and that's like, you know, 8 or 9 anime titles on there, and some like maybe Japanese pop like music videos or something. That's not a bad deal for me. So that's just a way for me to get cheap stuff.
Yeah, so, and I mean that was, and I'm glad that you took some of those titles off my hands. I've still got, you know, a box of stuff that I'm getting rid of because I guess the problem with the VHS is that that stuff is all magnetic. And while DVD at the very least is optical, so it'll actually last a bit longer, I suppose. Speaking of which, I bought Ghost in the Shell on VHS day one that it was released in America on home video. Big deal for me because I was for the like a month up to it, I was just going insane wanting to watch this movie because it was so like highly anticipated. I was trying to find out everything I could about it. I even have and this was this weird stuff that they gave away. I was on the Manga Entertainment, how do I call this? It was the Manga Entertainment, like, fan club. And they sent out with their members, for their members, they sent out a frame of the original 35mm film to their members. And I still have this somewhere. So just weird stuff that they sent out like that.
Is this like sort of a reprint that they did, or is this like off the original 35mm?
It was off of – I mean, I doubt that they would cut up their original like archival 35mm for their fans.
Yeah.
So it must be off of just a film print. Like they just cut some of the film bits up, like a couple of frames of it, and just sent it out to everybody.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it was a neat time. I'm glad it's gone. Glad it's no longer here, but it was an interesting time.
Interesting enough, that was the first time you said Ghost in the Shell in about 20 minutes.
Yeah, I was trying to bring it back.
No, you're doing exactly what our podcast does. Go off topic about whatever we're supposed to be talking about. You're doing fine, Gerald. I don't know if it's the same for Anime World Order, unless like you guys do a very good job editing, thinking you guys are on topic a lot. But
no, we get off topic all the time. Especially for something like Ghost in the Shell Ghost in the Shell was so, it affected anime in such a wide degree.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of like, it's easy to go off topic on it because especially if you lived
through
that.
Everything's connected because it's like we talk about Ghost in the Shell on VHS, so we got to talk about anime on VHS. Well, how was the market back then? How did they promote it? Blah, 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 blah.
Right.
You can't help it. Yeah.
I mean, what are your guys' thoughts on Ghost in the Shell? Have you guys seen Innocence?
John, have you seen Innocence?
Yeah, I saw the sequel.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can answer real quick. Like, I rented it from Blockbuster, like, in high school when it came out on DVD. Like, when they – I actually own – yeah, I own, like, the – I think it's the version by Sony that they put out first. Because I got that for, like, $2 at Blockbuster on sale or something. Mm-hmm. And I don't have any of the later, like, out-of-print releases of Innocence either. But I just remember watching it. And I thought it was, like, I didn't really make sense to me or anything. Because I think, like, earlier than that, maybe a year or so earlier is when I saw – or when I rented Ghost in the Shell from Blockbuster. And I just remember, like, liking Ghost in the Shell. But I was just like, all right, well, this is kind of sort of a rite of passage thing. People talk about this movie a lot. And I didn't really – put too much thought into ever owning it until like much, much later, which is kind of like, I'm really glad that I own like two different copies of the movie. I think I might have it on VHS maybe. Knowing me, I probably do, but then I, you know, and then later I rented Ghost in the Shell 2 and saw it. I just remember like, I remember liking the scene where there's a shootout because there was one of the guys that had a FAMAS gun and I had a FAMAS airsoft gun at the time. And I was like, well, this movie's awesome. But that doesn't really answer for the rest of the movie. But I can't remember really much of what happens in Innocence.
It's because no one does.
Yeah, Innocence, I don't remember much about it either.
Yeah, it was such a slow movie, and so and yeah, he was so Ghost Mamoroshi was so just not interested in making that movie because Ghost in the Shell, the first one, like you could very much argue this is an action movie with a message, mm-hmm. And Ghost in the Shell Innocence, you could say that is basically Talking Heads with an action bit here and there thrown in.
The live-action Talking Head that off of his movies, right, back in the 80s?
It was so slow.
Yeah, like, I own those live-action Goshi movies thinking that, like, when I bought them online, when I had, like, when I was employed full-time, so this was, like, maybe 5-6 years ago, I was like, I saw YouTube clips of, like, oh, it's like the Jinro armor, and they're having a cool shootout. And that's all they showed on in the internet. I was like, well, this movie looks awesome, and then I get it. And that's the only awesome part of the movie. The rest is just the camera following somebody and people getting shrimp and working in animation studios and getting lost and having bad comedy. And I'm literally talking about three movies in one sentence. And I had that collection in the back corner of my DVD section.
Oshii is weird in that. I mean, he's a lot like a Tamino in that – what he really likes to do, nobody else wants to see. Oshii really is – I mean, the sad thing is that Oshii is really good at comedy but doesn't do comedy. I loved Pat Labor and Yudus and the – you know, some a lot of Yudus Sayatsura was great, and especially the OVAs of Pat Labor that were very much comedic. Mm-hmm. But he just doesn't want to do comedy. He wants to do these sort of – deep philosophical things, which are not necessarily bad, but God, they are.
It's too boring.
Yeah, I wish.
I feel like if he does it too much all the time, at least in the part like that's the highlight of the Oshii making movies in that 10-year period or whatever. And it's like if he did like half comedy, then it would be like a breath of fresh air every single time.
It's also that he is one of those last generations. That what he wanted to do was direct film. And mm-hmm. because he couldn't cut it in film at the time, he went into animation. And then so he would, you know, take steps into live-action film, and then you see why he couldn't cut it for film. Because the films he make have got one or two awesome scenes or some awesome designs mm-hmm. and are just impossible to watch any other time.
I mean, it's great that he did the beautiful, like, you know, the Yuri Yatsura, you know, he did like half the series and then plus the first two films. And like, the way I understood it from the book was him and Rumiko Takahashi never got along. I mean, like,
no,
you're basically
adapting, because...
you know, this manga into TV and it's not the way the manga author wants it. And so, of course, there's going to be a lot of friction there.
I want to believe that she really hated it because she saw the stuff and said, damn it, it's a lot better than anything I did. I've tried to read her manga. I read like a bunch of Maison Ikkoku. I watched a bunch of Maison Ikkoku, and this was this like lauded anime was, everybody was talking about, oh, this is the greatest like romantic comedy anime ever, and I'm like, this is a yet another show that could be like 13 episodes, but because of misunderstanding after misunderstanding, it just goes on for fucking ever, and that's all she does is...
In every series that she does.
Sorry?
In every single series that she does, it's like that.
Yes, it's like, oh, well, I just passed by. Oh, I really like this guy. Oh, wait, what's he doing with this other person at a restaurant? Well, rather than asking, let me have another 13 episodes where I think he's cheating on me or he doesn't like me anymore. And,
dude, that's what girls like!
Yeah.
I will say this, like I own the first, I think, three episodes of Ranma 1/2 on VHS, and that's like the thick clamshell ones, and I gotta say, like Ranma 1/2 or whatever, it's just not for me. Like I just couldn't get into it. Maybe
Ranma
if I saw it,
I would
watch it, but I don't know.
It is a very typical straight up sitcom. And it's one of those things where I would quite happily watch it, if it were streaming. But I don't think it's a show that you really want to own.
It's like people that own Friends. Like, Friends is funny on TV once, because, like, if you watch it again, you know the jokes. Then it's not as funny.
Yeah. I mean, and especially, like, would you buy Friends three episodes at a time on DVD? I mean, that's a joke. Like, no one would buy Friends three episodes at a time. That's how kind of Ranma 1/2 is, how all of her stuff is. And apparently no one likes Renee now, which is her new work.
I thought the first three episodes were okay, but
it's not doing very well, I understand. Like, it doesn't have the penetration that pretty much all of her other stuff has.
Yeah.
And the stuff that I like the most with her are her shorts, like the Supergirl and some of the Mermaid's Forest stuff.
Okay.
But yeah, I think Oshii did a much better job than she ever did on a lot of that stuff. And so I think Oshii improved the Ghost in the Shell manga. I mean, what was there? But I mean, if you've watched a lot of Ghost in the Shell, you basically see that they tell one story over and over and over again. And the one story is always, there is some amazing hacker. There is some, you know, fantastic, like, unbelievable hacker who is getting in and causing robots to malfunction or people to malfunction or whatever it is to malfunction. And Section 9 has to figure this out, usually with a shootout at some point.
Yeah.
And it's how you tell that changes it up from the procedural to the philosophical to the nothing is fucking going on and no one cares. Yeah, it's basically that... basically the same story over and over again. I mean, that was what it was for Standalone Complex, mostly.
I never finished Standalone Complex, and I did tape the episodes off, like, when it was on Adult Swim, you know, a decade ago, but I never finished it.
I haven't finished watching them.
It wasn't like it was a bad show. It was just kind of like for some reason, I just stopped.
It is a show that is very dense. Very dense. Standalone Complex is not something you watch necessarily for entertainment. I tried showing Standalone Complex at my anime nights, and the entire audience, basically, a good portion of the audience said, this is too boring. Like, it's just an episode of people talking, like, constantly. And it's true. That's what Standalone Complex is. I mean, Mamoru Oshii, even though he didn't do Standalone Complex, his stylistic trademark are extended monologues.
Mm-hmm.
And he uses about two of them in Ghost in the Shell, like the one on the boat, if you remember.
Yeah, the conversation like between, oh, you want to get out of Section 9 and everything.
The one after that where she was talking about, you know, what it means to be human, how, you know,
yeah.
I eat things, I feel things. Is this what it means to be human?
Yeah, that's a really good line.
Yeah, I mean, it's like kind of comes out of nowhere. For that scene, but it's again that is very much his trademark. He did that in Pat Labor 2. He's done it in mm-hmm. Beautiful Dreamer. A lot of pretty much all of his work.
He also brings up. Oshii does bring up biblical scripture in his anime, and he did it like for only like once in Ghost in the Shell at the very end, where it was, you know, when I was a child, I spoke like a child, mm-hmm. and when I, you know, that whole line. But and I'm sure there's
he is one of the only people. Where if the Bible is brought up it's for a specific purpose.
Yes.
Because he actually trained as a – he was going to go into seminary.
Yeah.
And backed out of it. So he – it is not like Neon Genesis Evangelion, where as much as the fans want to believe it, that religious context is – it's only there to look cool. It's – and I mean, the biggest thing that no one ever wants to talk about with Neon Genesis Evangelion is that Gainax joked the entire Western world into admitting that they know nothing about their own religion. whether you are religious or aren't religious, it doesn't matter. You're in the Western world. It's Christianity is part of your culture, and we know nothing about it. And Gainax was able to prove that very, very well. Say, well, you don't
know
anything.
I am so glad that they were able to prove that. So
yeah, everyone was like, "Oh my gosh, this is so deep. This is so no." If we actually knew anything about the religion that's part of our culture, we would realize, "Oh, this means nothing. Like it's just a character that's crucified. Oh, there's a bunch of like crosses that come up out of the ground as explosions. What does this mean? It means nothing. It's just there to look cool." But Oshii is different in that if you read any interviews with him, he did an interview in An America way back when that if you can find
that. Is that the one that was translated by Carl Horn that's got the Ghost in the Shell cover on it? Because I own that issue, and that's the interview I've read about him.
That might be the interview I'm thinking of. It was an excellent interview, and you see that Oshii thinks about things in a very different way. Like he was during the interview, he was saying, I have to think about this in a, it's very different being, a man than it is a woman. Like he was mentioning like, a man can like a human person never comes out of a man, but a woman, like a human person, like comes out of a woman. Like they live with a human inside them. And, this is a very different sort of thing. Like, men will never understand this or experience this. And, this is, what I was thinking of when I was working on Ghost in the Shell. what is it like to have, to give life to something? And, I mean, these are the sorts of things that he thinks about. So,
yeah,
that's his movies. That's why it's a shame that he doesn't want to do anything fun anymore. Because, it would be nice if he could inject some fun into these works that he thinks about so much.
Well, it's also the fact that I think that's the same interview where he's just like, I think Horn or Carl Horn was asking him like, what's the purpose of these adding these themes? And I think he's like, when I look back at some of the stuff I did, I don't even know what I was trying to put in there half the time. I remember that line being in there, but then there was also the one, and it was funny because like even in Ghost in the Shell between Motoko and the Puppet Master, there was like having this sort of like the Puppet Master's looking for like a cybernetic mate in a way. And so that's like his mate that he chose for Motoko to bear like this, internet child offspring kind of. And that's sort of like the verbatim way of doing it. There's a nicer way of saying it, but that's kind of like an internet child, I guess. Or like a being that you can be, that can be made through the net.
Yeah, it was that idea that, if I combine this consciousness and that, our two consciences together, and I disappear, and I can create something that is not like the two of us.
Yeah, and it's still the human desire and natural ability to pass on your genes, with a mate and everything. That's just genetically embedded in us. That's our survival. That's how we continue to know our existence is through that.
So it is very interesting to read any interview with Oshii. He is a very interesting guy. Out of that came an interesting movie, Ghost in the Shell. And I'm glad it was made. I mean, this movie was made in a year. And it's impressive what they did in a year, in a year's time. The soundtrack to it is really great. I'm glad that it's a shame that no one is – that it's kind of the end of that Akira era where people were willing to be very experimental with their anime movies. Like, I don't think anybody would have thought to use that sort of soundtrack today. It is definitely a classic, and I'm glad that I'm hope that it gets some more exposure. Like, I don't think it's streaming anywhere.
I guess not.
No, probably not, because Manga Entertainment doesn't really know what's up anymore. I'm amazed that they actually exist.
They exist in some way, somehow.
I messaged them And I asked them, you know, how do you guys stay around? What are you guys doing? And they said, well, what are you talking about? We put out our videos on YouTube, and there are these videos about there's just these videos of like hot pepper anime. Let's eat a hot pepper and review an anime. They aren't actually putting out any content, anime content of any sort anymore. And yeah. I don't know how they actually exist.
Well, interesting enough, this recording has been going on as long as the movie.
Oh, that's no surprise.
Yeah, I think in terms of us actually talking about Ghost in the Shell, it's about 30 or so minutes of that.
Not a surprise. You knew what you were getting into when you had me on.
No, that's why I wanted to have you on, because I was like, okay, he's, you know, I wanted all this history and this know-how of like how did it affect you as an anime fan and others at the time that I, you know, wasn't aware of. And
it was also where James Cameron tried to butt in all the time and try to be, you know, try to show, you know, how cool a guy he was with his anime knowledge. He got a quote on the video cassette box when it was released.
Oh.
But yeah, James Cameron, who seems to just have the rights to Battle Angel held down forever and ever and ever, is never going to make that movie.
It makes you wonder, what's going to come out first, the live-action Ghost in the Shell or Battle Angel Alita?
Well, the live-action Ghost, again, yeah, that, I mean, they're casting that movie. They are, I guess, getting a director together, but they do have... they just got a writer. The writer of Straight Outta Compton is writing the movie. But until it starts filming, it doesn't really exist. And I think that will come out. Battle Angel Alita won't. James Cameron is going to continue making Avatar movies until the one that one makes only like $1.5 billion. And then he's going to be like, this is not worth it. And then might make Battle Angel. And that has been a thing since the mid 90s. You know, he has had the rights to that for that long.
I just know, like, in terms of old anime magazines that I had, there was something I came across where there was talks of them coming up with a live-action Akira. So, like, talking about a live-action Akira is nothing new in the past 20, 25 years.
It's happened about two or three times. And I actually had a friend who was working on the pre-production for the live-action Akira movie. And then that whole thing got shut down. And that was probably a good thing, because they were going in a stupid direction with it. All these things, there was going to be a live-action Yamato movie. They even supposedly had like a prop built for it. There was going to be a live-action Sailor Moon movie with Meryl Streep at some point. There was going to be a live-action By the Psychic Girl movie. As long as I've been an anime fan, I've been hearing this stuff.
Hey, man, I'm still banking on that Robotech live-action with Tobey Maguire. Can't tell me that's not impossible.
I don't think I'm so upset that that's happening so much as the live-action Robotech movie unnecessarily legitimizes the existence of Robotech. And Robotech should not exist anymore, because Harmony Gold shouldn't exist anymore.
Thank you.
People don't remember this, but Harmony Gold is a real estate company that has a few film and movie and media licenses. But largely, they own Hollywood real estate.
And yet they're ruining Macross for the Western world.
Yeah, it wouldn't be as bad. They can have all the Robotech they want, but them doing that prevents me from getting my Macross. So they need to die. And all the neckbeard, old-ass, 45-year-old anime fans need to die as well and stop pretending that Robotech was actually not worse than the original material it came from. And this is coming from someone who started in Robotech. So, let's see. Is there much more to say about Ghost in the Shell? It seems like we've kind of covered most of the bases.
Yeah, I think
here.
We've covered just about everything and hit that nail on the head way past the surface of the wood at this point.
probably.
John's been really quiet the whole time. John, please share us your opinions of Ghost in the Shell.
It's hard to say more than we already have about it, but it can be boring at times, but it's also sort of interesting. It's a lot different than most other anime with how philosophical it is, and I haven't seen the 2.0 remake, but I don't really plan to after what I've just heard about it, so.
Yeah, it's not really necessary.
Yeah.
I bought it on a whim when I got it, but I was like, I had no desire to see it, but it's like, hey, the original version's on here, so I've got two ways of watching it, so.
Oh, yep. You just bought it for the original version on the special features?
I didn't really know the original version was on there, cause like, the 2.0 was like in a $4 bin at some like, Walmart or something, and I was like, that's $4.
What year did that come out?
What, 2009 was when 2.0 came out, maybe?
Something. It was relatively recently, like within the last 5-6 years.
Yeah. It kind of came out when, like, Blu-rays really started to hit.
It was one of the last Blu-rays that Manga Entertainment did. I think they did it a bit after Redline.
Yeah, maybe? I've got Redline on Blu-ray.
And I think that was the last deep Blu-ray that they put out, and now it's just like, how the hell are they still subsisting?
Through videos of them reviewing things with Chili Peppers.
Yes, pretty much.
Well, I think I first saw it on Anna Monday on Sci-Fi Channel, which probably would have been around the time 2.0 came out, because that was late 2000s that they had started airing anime on Sci-Fi Channel again. And I do remember they censored the nudity, but I think other than some bars on the screen, it was uncut.
Yeah, because you can show as much violence as you want on American TV, but showing breasts is just will destroy society.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's funny because I remember when they aired Fatal Fury on the Sci-Fi Channel years ago. Yeah. I hope that I have a copy of that somewhere, because. When Mai Shiranui, if you know who she is, of course you know who she is, appeared on screen, her outfit is so revealing that anytime she was on screen, they had to have these giant, like, fuzzy blocks on her. It was hilarious.
I mean, there's really only the shower scene that there's nudity
that she's
in that
nude
movie.
In, but she, apparently, I guess, standards and practices, like, she is bearing enough skin and there is enough of her breast exposed during her in her regular outfit that they had to just have these big fuzzy bars on her all the time. Like, she's wearing basically a thong, and so her buttocks are exposed. I have to have that on there all the time. It's hilarious.
Oh my gosh. Well, this was the same network that had, like, I think, Dominion Tank Police, and I heard that they took out the boner deterrents, or like they put in like basically balls or something. That's what I heard.
Yeah, the dick bombs. Yeah, that's, yeah. Yeah, I remember. I used to watch the sci-fi. That was one of the first time. That was I used to watch it on the Memorial Day celebration when it was hosted by Ralph Bakshi.
Nice.
I don't know what the hell he was doing there, but
the only anime I remember watching on, because they used to put it on Saturday mornings like in the early 2000s. It might have been like 2000, 2001. Was they would show like movies on there too on Saturdays, and I wound up watching what I didn't know at the time was Rosen Z, and
yes,
I got really into Rosen Z, but I was like conflicted because like they had the Garlic Jr. saga on Dragon Ball Z on Saturdays, so like I'm flipping back and forth between like old man in like a hospital bed like katamari-ing everything in Japan compared to talking and yelling with a green guy. So I was like, I don't know what to do.
Well, at the very least, all you have to do is watch a couple of minutes of Dragon Ball Z, and then you can basically watch the whole movie and then not miss anything with Dragon Ball Z.
I know, but 14-year-old me didn't know better, Gerald. Have pity. Well, I think we've talked about Ghost in the Shell, but I think we have another segment that we do, Gerald, called Closing Remarks. Mm-hmm. And Closing Remarks is basically, you know, you're released from your leash. You can go, you can talk about whatever, ramble about whatever concerns you. I mean, granted, we've kind of done that in the context of Ghost in the Shell, but closing remarks kind of like where we can go, if we talk about politics or anything stupid. We mostly talk about Chris Chan, or at least John does. He updates me on information about Chris Chan, because that's one of our pillars of foundations for this podcast somehow. And, so we figured that, since you're our guest, if you got something you wanted to talk about for closing remarks that's unrelated to anime or anything that bugs you or something, just let it out there.
Let's see. Unrelated to anime. Well, I guess I can talk about what's on my mind without any spoilers, which is I'm quite upset that I've been playing The Phantom Pain, and again, I have no spoilers at all, but I must say that the storyline in Phantom Pain is remarkable in that as a person from Africa, I can tell you that he got the politics of Africa at the time right, that he's got the languages right, and it's a shame that someone who has put so much work into something that is extremely unattractive on its surface. I mean, who is interested in playing a game set in Kabul, Afghanistan, and Central Africa in the 80s? And it's upsetting that someone has gone out on a limb to make a game like this that actually researched and got things down. And his reward for that is he doesn't have a job anymore. That has been on my mind for a while.
Here's my thing. Like, Kojima has so much talent, and you know he can get the talent to start his own game company and do something else. And maybe even get his old properties like Snatcher and Police Knots from Konami and do sequels or remakes or something off of that. So, yeah, it's not very likely that we're ever going to see a Zone of the Enders 3, but I mean, like, at least with him going out and doing his own thing, like, people are going to support him. He puts out a Kickstarter for something, he's got the money instantly within a day.
Yeah, I mean, I was upset that Konami is such a stupid company that they released that amazing PT, and as soon as the Silent Hills project stopped, they didn't just leave PT up there so people could enjoy it. It's just gone. Like, when your only way to watch this game is to actually have to go to goddamn, like, Let's Players on YouTube, that's harsh. Like, this thing, it just does not exist anymore. It's a real shame. It's a shame because what's been on my mind a lot is that this proliferation of these garbage free-to-play games, that everybody plays some of them. Some of us know people who that is all they play. Some of us know that there are some people that the moment that they sit down in a group of people, they pull out their phone or their tablet, and they have just disappeared into Puzzles and Dragons or whatever it might be. And these garbage free-to-play games that have got no story and have got nothing to say are ruining, I think, a good story, good potential storytelling, like Phantom Pain.
Mm-hmm.
So that is what has been on my mind.
I mean, there was a period where I played a little bit of Puzzles and Dragons, but that's
everybody plays. Everybody plays some of those games. Everybody does. It is.
Yeah, I haven't touched it in months, but probably because it's like maybe I don't care anymore. I don't know, but
everybody plays some of those games. But it's a matter of, is this your, if you play games and this is your predominant way of playing games, and
that's,
like, I wonder.
Yeah, I see that. Yeah, I see that. Like, for me, it was just like a time killer while I'm waiting for Chinese food or something. Like, I'm not someone that pulls out my smartphone and it's like, oh, don't look at me. Look at me as I play this game on my phone. Like, I'm not that person.
I'm sure that most of us have got friends who will pull those games out in social situations. And
that's why I don't socialize with those people too much. But I know them.
And so it's a shame because I believe that, you know, you can tell good stories through games, but you cannot still tell good stories through free-to-play games.
Yeah, I agree with you. I guess it all depends on the purpose of the person making a free-to-play game if they want to go through the trouble of adding a story to it.
Well, so the purpose of a free-to-play game is to convert every customer into a paying customer, either through making the game take too long to get anywhere, or just to, you know, or eventually they leave. If they're not going to get any money out of them at a certain point, just, you know, make it so you can't progress. Because no one is making a free-to-play game to genuinely make a game that is free-to-play.
Yeah, that kind of defeats the purpose. They already did a South Park episode parody off of that, which was actually pretty good.
Yeah, I need to watch it. I've heard that it kind of skewers all that stuff.
I will say this. It's got the best alcohol advertising by Trey Parker and Matt Stone that you'll ever see.
Oh, I do need to watch that.
Yeah, just saying that is, once you see it, you'd be like, okay, That is a pretty good alcohol advertisement. So, John, what do you have for closing remarks?
Yeah, on the subject of the free-to-play thing, Steve sent me an invite to play something called Bejeweled Blitz on Facebook recently, but I don't think I'm going to.
those Facebook games bother me so much because it'll just be like a simple game that somehow needs access to your address, your phone number, your email address, like all the stuff.
And your credit
all
card number.
All the plant crops on a virtual environment. I never understood Farmville.
That's why I've never, ever played one of those games on Facebook because it's just too connected. I mean, Facebook is awful anyway, and that all these apps like just have way too much access.
John, was there anything else?
Yeah, I guess since you mentioned Chris Chan, I might as well read something from
him. Well, it's typical we have to talk about Chris Chan, or at least you do.
Yeah. Okay, so this is from the Amiibo descriptions. He's released a bunch of Amiibos for his stupid Sonic 2 characters. He says, Robbie Sonichu is a female soul born into the male body with attraction and kind friendships with women around her age. Self-identified as a lesbian trans woman, she likes to follow in her father's footsteps, almost literally, by looking to be able to run as fast as or faster than her father. She also helps defend the hometown and friends from incoming bullies from Count Graduan's army with her strong electric attacks and speed, and she likes to run and spark with style and sass. There's like a ton of these that he's released. I don't know how people can justify spending $120 on the Chandler Family Pack, which is amiibos of him and his mother and father, but they must for him to be able to put out so many of these things.
I'm going to assume that this is a person who is a Sonic the Hedgehog fan.
Yeah. He's made like all these...
It goes deeper than that, Gerald. You don't want to go down that road. Oh. I guess for me, that I had a wisdom tooth pulled Tuesday, so that was fun. And now it's clotting up pretty well, so it's not bleeding as much.
Oof.
I don't know if you guys have ever gone through that process before.
No.
No, I haven't.
Doesn't sound fun.
I don't know. People, like, I mentioned wisdom tooth as in, like, one tooth, and everyone's like, so your whole mouth is jaw, right? Because you got all four of them out. I'm like... No, just the one. And everyone's telling me like all these horror stories about like having all four of them out. And one's like, I lost 20 pounds because I couldn't eat anything. And I'm like, dadgummit, I gotta, and apparently they're all bad in my mouth. So it's like, I gotta get that taken care of eventually.
So you have to remove the other ones now?
At some point, yes.
Why did they only do one of them? Is it cost issues or?
Sort of at the moment, so it's just easier to do the one since it was in the worst shape.
Hmm.
Now, I think the only other thing I want to say is actually kind of like a year and a half way too late to say this, but Gerald, I think your Giant Gorg review is completely inaccurate, and Giant Gorg is the greatest show ever made. Telling you that right now, and I don't say it in the comments, I say it to your face, or at least to your Skype avatar. That's
hey,
my
it's
general
okay.
defense I'm bearing.
It's okay. I stand by that review. I still say it's a show that would be good 13 episodes, but nothing happens.
I mean, yeah, like the first four episodes were fantastic, and like that's what sucked me in. But then it's like I just kept watching because of just how it ended, and like I'm a sucker for shows that have that cliffhanger ending. And it's like I know that the characters are gonna live, they're gonna get out of this situation, but I gotta know how. And the build-up is killing me, so then I gotta watch the next one, and then the next one.
Unfortunately, those cliffhanger endings were only part of those first couple of episodes. As the series went on, they decided to abandon those cliffhangers. I was sad.
Well,
so that was a good way to go from episode to episode.
There was that one about, like, the main characters were trapped in that, like, tent that was on fire. And that ended, that was, like, a cliffhanger ending there.
Yes. Unfortunately, so, like, it didn't become like the predominant way of ending the episodes.
I'm not sure which version of the fan subs you saw, but one of them was they had, I guess the fan subs like took what was on the computer screen. It was like, oh, here are the lyrics from this old British sci-fi show UFO or whatever.
Hmm.
Because that was something interesting that I know, like, that I, when I saw it, it was like, hey, they made like a little, like, asterisk of like, hey, this is from a 69 science fiction show from, like, that was popular in Japan at the time. Huh, and then I saw, it on, like, the intro on YouTube, like, oh, okay.
That sounds about right, especially for the audience that was making that, or the people that were making that.
Yeah, because, like, it was at the time when, like, you know, they were, like, the anime fans were basically, like, all science fiction nerds. So, like, they were all watching, like, British shows that were coming over to Japan, or they watched it in some way that was really popular. Yeah, I'm just having fun with you.
So. Oh, no, I got a lot of shit for that review, and I still stand by it. I still am sad that Woody Allen never did anything in that entire show. He could have disappeared, and that the big guy that I would have normally liked did nothing except the last three episodes.
That's true.
So a review comes down to if another person doesn't agree with you but can at least see your point, then you're okay.
No, I mean, I see your point. I mean, but I was still just a really big. I just enjoyed Giant Gorg from start to finish. I mean, yeah, the first few episodes are really strong.
Right.
And I'll give you that. I mean, it's apparent right there, but I guess for me, it just kind of clicked. I guess that's about it for closing remarks. That's all I've got. Can't really think of anything else. Yeah, I'd like to have you back on the show. I know, like a year ago, I mentioned, like, I'd like to have you on whenever we review Gelforce. Because
sure.
I have all of those, like, between VHS and DVD. I'm not going to bring you on to talk about every single series because that would be a very, very long podcast probably. But at least in terms of like the first three movies, that would be good.
Yeah, I could probably just do the first trilogy of Gelforce.
Yeah. All right, well, I'm going to go ahead and tell everyone to get out of my Skype call.
It was good to be on, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. And we'll get this episode out in the next week or so, I'd say.
Okie doke.
I guess Daryl could put it on like, hey, Gerald was on the anime of yesteryear to talk about Ghost in the Shell or something. I don't know.
Sure. We'll cross promote, as that fancy term is. So I guess how it works with you guys is you hang up and then the recording is just over?
Well, I think with John, like, the recording goes on until he shuts down GarageBand, so.
Ah. Okay. I see how it works. So
all right.
It was thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, no problem. Take care.
Take care.
I engaged his field of vision. Normal function. Can you hear me, Beto?
Perfectly.
He's engaging my vocal function.
And he's now inside. My code name is Project 2501. Industrial espionage and intelligence manipulation. I have installed programs into specific ghosts in order to maximize the strategic advantage of certain organizations and selected individuals.